this is really meant to be just an informal slash informational session. None of us have prepared sort of full-fledged talks. None of us has slides or anything. It's really sort of a get-to-know-you session where four faculty members, including myself, will talk about our research a little bit, give newcomers a sense of the kind of stuff that we're up to, maybe update those of you who have been familiar with us in the past, with what we're doing most recently. And because I'm actually a panelist, I thought it would be odd for me to moderate as well. So I'm going to turn the moderating duties over to Jennifer Tischler, who I should introduce Jennifer as well. Jennifer is a long-standing associate director of CRECA, and you know, those of us who've been directors know that it's really Jennifer who runs CRECA. The rest of us are just kind of figureheads who do her bidding. But Jennifer, in that spirit, Jennifer's going to take over.
I guess I'm the timekeeper, then.
The moderating duties. And so once again, thank you for coming, and I'll turn the floor
over to you. So do I get to choose the order?
Yeah, you get to choose
the moderator. I guess we'll just go by order of who's sitting closest to me.
How long do I have, Jennifer?
Oh,
half an hour.
Half an hour.
We'll be out of here by 8.
I can 5 miles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so just introductory remarks about your current research, about teaching.
All right. So my name is Manon Vandewalder, and I am very happy that as of today or yesterday or whenever it was, 25th, I am a faculty member of the Department of Slavic Languages and Literature. Before that, I was actually already involved with CRECA because I've been 17 years at the university, but I'm also teaching in the Department of Theater and Drama, and that was where I was before. My background is in, I have a degree in Slavic language and literature from the University of Leiden, the Netherlands. I'm Dutch, that's what my accent is. Yeah. And I have a PhD in theater from Arizona State University with an emphasis in theater for youth. And particularly from my dissertation on at Arizona State University, but before that, I have been combining theater and Russian and theater for youth all over. So that's my main research interest, although I'm also going outside of that. Currently, I'm teaching the history of our Russian theater history, and there are like at least two members of that class are here, so thank you very much for being here. And my current research project that has to do with Russia is I am writing, well, actually more researching than writing. I have one chapter published, but researching a book, a biography of Natalia Sats. And for those of you who don't know who Natalia Sats is, she was 15 year old when she became the head of the children's theater section of the Moscow theater department of Soviet whatever in 1917 or 1918. She was 15 years old then. And she actually remained in theater until she died in 1993 in theater for youth, sort of spanning the whole Soviet area and becoming very much a victim and a beneficiary of the Soviet period. So.
Is that
finished?
Mm-hmm.
I'm finished. So.
I'm sure we're just getting started.
And then
we'll have the opportunity to cycle back in the Q&A.
So I'm Kathy Henley. I teach in the law school in the political science department and am a reform lawyer. So I had a life as a lawyer and then went back to graduate school and got a PhD in political science. And that's what kind of brought me on the path to here. So my, I think I have truly the oddest teaching package in the world because in the mornings I teach contract law. I don't see anybody from my class here. And in the afternoons I teach political science and I teach a freshman seminar on issues related to Russian law and then have another class on the U.S. legal system. And I regularly teach Russian politics, just not this year because of the freshman seminar. My research deals with legal reform in Russia. My approach is a bottom-up approach, so I spend a lot of time in Russia sitting in courts or doing focus groups or just talking to people about their attitudes towards law, and I'm just finishing a book called Everyday Law in Russia that is built on these focus groups and the observational work in the courts, and I'm just starting a project on the Russian legal profession. Which will be a cohort study, so we will, because the Russian legal profession is so balkanized, so broken up. It's really impossible to get at them once they're out there practicing law. So the idea is to capture them before they leave law school, so to create a sample of people as they're leaving law school, and then to return to them periodically to see how they construct a career, because when you look at the literature on the Russian legal profession, there really is nothing about the profession as a whole. It can be about advocati or about prokurori or jurisconsulti, but not about the whole profession. And now it's become very interesting because unlike the Soviet period where you're kind of stuck being whatever you were when you were, spit out into the system, now you can move in between these different professions. And so the question of how people construct a career and how they deal with clients and all that kind of stuff, I think has a lot of potential, and a lot of potential to create a really interesting database for other people. It's kind of a baseline database, so.
Okay, so I am a sociologist, and I've been working on Russia since my graduate studies back in, I won't say when. And I guess you could say I work on a range of topics within sociology. So initially, I think earlier in my career, I focused a lot on what we sociologists call social stratification, that is, structures of inequality. And I was very interested in how the collapse of communism affected the social structure, understood as sort of a hierarchical organization of people in terms of their income, in terms of their social status, in terms of their access to education. And so early on, I wrote a number of papers examining that theme in Russia to see how the collapse of the Soviet Union and the rise of market-like institutions affected, or did not affect, actually, the social structure, things like the effect of social origins on educational attainment, things of, such as labor market experiences. You know, who is it that lost their jobs? Who is it that experienced perhaps some windfalls as a result of the reforms? Over time, my work has broadened and shifted somewhat. So nowadays, I've been looking more at demographic processes, not so much mortality, which in Russia gets a lot of attention, but more looking at marriage and fertility, divorce, family formation. Turns out actually that so Russia is famous for its population decline during the 1990s and 2000s, and although at least according to the official data that seems to have been reversed lately, it's still a very real risk that there's a lot of suspicion that even if they sort of reverse that trend in the last few years, it's probably what demographers call a tempo effect and not a long-term effect. So the mortality crisis in Russia has got a lot of attention, but it's actually fertility rates that are more decisive for shaping the size of the population, it turns out. So I've done some stuff looking at fertility. Also, I've done some work on political attitudes, so it's kind of a hot topic now, you know, how different elements of Russia's population view Russia's political institutions, view issues like human rights and democracy, view the United States, view the country's trajectory. And I guess the three major projects I've been working on recently, one actually goes back to 2011, 2012. So at the time, you may recall there were elections in Russia, parliamentary elections and then presidential election. And there was a rise, you know, it's sort of hard to imagine this given where we are now, but there was a sudden explosion of protest activity in Russia surrounding the elections. There was a lot of public outrage at the evident election fraud in the parliamentary elections, and people were out on the streets in Moscow, and people were writing about the death of end of Putinism and the rise of Russia's middle class, and now we've been we've all been waiting for. We're going to have sweep into the dustbin of history this sort of authoritarian nationalistic state under Putin. Well, we know how that turned out in retrospect, but from my perspective, it was a particularly fruitful time because I happened to be involved in a survey, a data collection project, where we conducted a series of public opinion surveys before, during, and after the election period. So right now, I have a number of papers that finally I'm getting around to analyzing those data and getting out some academic analyses. Since then, I've also become interested in the topic of housing in Russia. So I collaborate with a sociologist at Arizona named Jane Zaviska, and we completed a study last year where we once again did a survey. So mainly I work with surveys, although usually I do focus groups too, do some interviews and connection with the survey projects. But we conducted a survey about housing experiences in Russia, where we asked people to recount all the changes in housing, all the houses, the dwellings they've lived in since 1991, as well as some brief sort of labor market histories and family formation histories, to see how housing conditions affect people's choices about when to have children, when to get married, you know, what types of jobs they have access to. I mean, if you've been to Russia, you know that housing is a big concern for many Russians, that the government stopped building housing, basically, after the collapse of communism, and they privatized housing. So if you were lucky enough to be living in a nice apartment that you'd gotten from the state and you had the ability to privatize it, then you're in good shape. But if you weren't, then you're really shut out of the system. There's not much of a market developing, so a lot of young people today have tremendous difficulty being able to buy housing. It's hard to get a mortgage and so forth. So we have this data set that we're just starting to analyze to look at sort of how housing in Russia has affected these demographic and also socioeconomic patterns. Now, just as we got those data, we actually then initiated a new project. So our new project is actually a four-country study where we're looking at the political dimensions of housing. We're looking at the degree to which concerns about housing translate into broader grievances against the government, broader grievances against other groups in society. We're looking at whether home ownership has these sorts of ideological ramifications that U.S. policy assumes. So, you know, we talk about America as being an ownership society, or at least some people talk about America as being an ownership society, and home ownership is a core, you know, more Americans own their homes than people do in most countries. It's thought to be a core sort of component of that ownership society, and that supposedly creates all these nice things like, you know, investment in the political system, belief in the market economy, individualism, and so on and so forth. And so we're seeing if these kinds of ideas about ownership and also about the potential for housing to lead to various types of grievances, whether they apply in the post-socialist world. So to do this, it's a five-year project, so there's going to be several rounds of data collection. We're looking at Azerbaijan, Kyrgyzstan, Ukraine, and Russia. It's kind of hard to do a study where two of the countries are at war, but so far we've been able to negotiate that. We've done the focus groups just this last summer, so we're getting ramped up to do the surveys, but it'll be a while before we have any results to speak of in that. So that's sort of what I've been working on the last couple of years in a nutshell.
Thanks.
Well, thanks, Jennifer. I'm a historian of the Russian Empire. There's two of us in the history department that work on Russia or the Soviet Union, Francine Hirsch, who does the 20th century Soviet and post-Soviet space, and I work on the empire chiefly from the time of Charles, from the early 17th century up through World War One. I'm on leave this semester. Next semester I'll be offering a course on Russia from 1801 until I usually get into the war, but into the First World War, but try and get to 1917 for a change. And then a graduate seminar in intellectual history, which is one of my research interests, sort of the development or the way historians and writers have thought about the emergence of what they would call an identifiable canon, sort of an apostolic succession of social and political thinkers from the mid-18th century to the to 1909, 1914. Non-historians are very welcome into it, and I'd actually urge non-historians to come into it. Certainly if you're interested in literature or interested even in Russian and Soviet politics, one of the arguments underlying the seminar is a lot of ways that people think and talk about politics, talk about power, talk about history, talk about change, a lot of those ways of thinking and talking and sort of what we call discourses, sets of terms that seem automatically collated with one another in different cultures. They all take shape during that period. My research interests really have shifted like everybody else's over the years. I began as a historian of Russian institutions, basically the late autocracy, looked at foreign policy formation just before World War One to see how the autocracy worked and whether it was holding together. We tend to think of the revolution as coming up from a popular upsurge of gathering discontent, sort of the pressure cooker theory. It's the way you guys talk about, I'm Canadian, so I'll say you guys, the way you guys talk about your revolution, about these mounting injustices, and then boom. But there, just as one might argue in the American Revolution, what I've found and what I've argued is that in the case of revolution in Russia in 1905 and then twice in 1917, the state as an enterprise and governance as an enterprise really had become the subject of either insuperable disagreement among senior officials or the enterprise itself stopped making sense to a second echelon of officials. But since then, I've shifted more into intellectual and straight up political history. I'm just coming to the end of what's been a 8-year to 10-year project that I've more directed. I'm one of three general editors of this project. It's called Russia's Great War and Revolution, 1914 to 1922. Starting this year, there's going to roll out 23 books dealing. We've got 9 editorial teams, each of which deals with a different theme in the experience among Russians and subjects of the emperor in 1914, how they experienced the years of the war and going through the revolution and into the creation of the Soviet Union. There's, 27 editors grouped in these 9 teams, and we've got over 250 contributors from all over the world who have offered their scholarships, everything from grad students to old senior professors like myself. But that's coming out. But what I've shifted to is actually a problem. As I'm coming out of that, I've shifted to a problem that appears inconsequential in a lot of what we'd call the historiography, the way historians talk and write about a given period. And again, going back to this period from 1905 to 1917, and I'm interested in a problem that does not make sense to Americans and to Russians. It's called responsible government. It's the idea that if you watch C-SPAN or that, the idea that, say, Prime Minister Cameron's government or Prime Minister Harper's in Canada, they hold power as long as they command a majority of the seats in the House of Commons, right? The executive is right in the legislative. And this becomes a really big issue with the creation of legislative body, the State Duma, after 1905. And there's a group of people across the center to the left wing, the near left wing of the spectrum, but a plurality of the Duma deputies who really want to create responsible government, but they can't figure out how to do it. And I'm looking at the genealogy of the concept. They sort of always invoke it, but it's all about how did people, if we look at the state as representing one complex, civil society, as they would have called themselves, saw themselves performing a different role, and yet the more you push them, at least from what I can see, they never thought of the mechanisms of change. How do you get from point A to point B, and how do you think of that in real political terms, and how do you press your advantage? And it's one of what's emerging is it becomes one of those shear points, one of those unbridgeable gaps between how do you have a popular representative body to the extent that Duma was, and how does it capture, domesticate a power that has previously positioned itself above and beyond it. And actually that has a lot to do with the types of political problems that people have been interested in looking at the emergence of Putinism and expectations of political change in contemporary Russia. Again, going back to these continuities from the imperial period.
Okay, so before we open up the floor for discussion, I have a question myself that I'd like to ask, since we have a good assembly of graduate students, new and on and continuing, and you've presented yourselves as senior scholars in the region. I just wanted you to reflect on the changes in the field since when you started your own graduate career, but specifically two issues that I was thinking of. One is field research and access to the region, the sense that things were closed, then they sprang open, now they're coming closed again. And the second would be opportunities for collaboration with scholars of the region, from the region, if you know. So who would like to start with that? Kathy.
Well, I do a lot of field research in the sense of spending a lot of time in the region, which I think Jennifer knows. And access is always a problem, a lot of it is built on personal relationships rather than formal letters of any kind. They seem to mean almost nothing. And to be honest, I haven't had that much trouble with the latest version of things getting more difficult. I was there when Crimea blew up. I was there when, you know, I was there during March. And, you know, I spent some time in one of the top courts and was talking to the chief judge there, and he said something like, oh, we should collaborate on doing a conference or something. And I said, oh, I thought I was the enemy. And he said, oh, no, 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 no. So you never know, right? And so I think it depends on the context. When I started doing research in a new kind of court, you know, that became a whole different kind of campaign in terms of trying to figure out how to get access there. So, I mean, I certainly have experienced in the 90s, you know, when anti-Americanism rose, then it became more difficult, and it really does have an impact. I think that what has changed since I was a graduate student, because I think Ted and I are about of the same cohort, there was only one way to go to Russia when I was a graduate student, and that was on IREX, and that was a very, very small funnel. And the great thing now is, you know, basically you just buy a visa and you go. And be careful not to buy a tourist visa. You buy a business visa. If you buy a tourist visa, and then maybe you get kicked out again. But but everything depends on you. You know, nobody's helping you. Nobody's other than your personal contacts. But there's no real infrastructure. But I think that's a great thing. It's certainly a huge change from, and you can live wherever you want. It's more expensive, but it's just much freer in that way than it used to be. And in terms of collaborating with people on the ground there, I may work in a somewhat odd area because there really is no field of legal sociology. There never was in Russia. Most European countries take a more doctrinal view of law in terms of just being interested in what the law says on paper. And Russia is somewhat an extreme example of that. That's beginning to change. When I first went and was doing, I spent a lot of time in factories and in courts, and you know, the scholars would just say, you know, like, what, you want to be a member of the proletariat? What's this all about? You know, and they just could not, over and over again, I would get dragged into someone's office and it would be explained to me what I was doing was not a dissertation, right? And that, one has to be prepared for that too, you know, the being told over and over again that what you're doing is crap.
And from both sides, from the American side.
Right. Well, the American side, you've gone through your dissertation committee, but Russians have a very different idea of what, you know, what is an interesting question. And the idea of studying what law is and how law works and asking ordinary people about law, there are very few people in Russia that think this is an interesting question. And so that limits my set of people to work with. And in fact, when I did a Fulbright a couple of years ago and I had to have a formal affiliation, I really didn't know that many people in universities because these people are not terribly interesting to me. I knew a lot of judges. You know, I knew a lot of people that worked in factories, but and you know, I worked something out. But I ended up teaching at the New School of Economics which doesn't have a law program, right? Mm-hmm. Which was interesting too. But because the law people just were not interested in me, and vice versa. So, but as I say, there's a group at European University in St. Petersburg that's doing some good legal sociology, and there's some at the Higher School of Economics. So it's beginning to change, but it's very, very, very slow.
Mm-hmm. So since I'm working mostly with artists, and my field research is, and not so much with academic people, it's a little bit easier, and it got easier certainly after the fall of the Soviet Union, because before that, you know what you're saying, it's all legal, it's kind of very hard to get somewhere, and there was still a lot of doubt. It has always been, before and after, until now, like, who do you know? Because without context, I don't think you can get anywhere in Russia, and then it kind of like starts circulating. And I definitely feel that, this is all sort of like a reaction on what you said, I definitely feel there's an advantage in being Dutch, because I am, you know, I'm dual nationality, but I will say I'm Dutch, and it really kind of like makes a huge difference, generally. Except that since I have, this is not that long, I only have my dual nationality a year and a half, and I figured out that I cannot get a visa on my Dutch passport anymore, which is sort of annoying because the US, the Russian visa in the US passport is also three times as expensive. Yeah. Speaking about your business visa.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of like in this bureaucratic thing, but kind of like being able to say that you are non-American is definitely an advantage. No, and this is maybe also in comparison to the fields that you are working in, because now, still, you know, I think that the artists are the most outspoken of anyone, and so I have no problem if, in fact, I think that that it's getting increasingly, they are getting increasingly more daring, and one of my main contacts is working for the Russian Federation of Theater, and that organization is also kind of like sort of like under the table or under the carpet is pushing for kind of like more daring research workshops, etc., which actually maybe 10 years ago I couldn't have done yet. So so for me it kind of like is still okay.
David.
My experience, mine's strictly academic, that I work with archivists, librarians, and colleagues, mainly in the two independent universities, the Higher School of Economics in Moscow and European University in St. Petersburg. On that level, or archival access, I haven't experienced any closing or anything at all. That, as a matter of fact, there's very conflicting signals that those of you who read Russian papers or aggregators on the internet, you get these essays by the likes of what's his name, Dugin, and the usual gang of idiots, as he's called the editorial staff at Mad Magazine, but who are preaching this sort of Eurasian, this boiled down, vulgarized Eurasianism, and who's a Sechin wants to reinstitute a planned economy, in essence, and you see all this. And you go to Russia and you talk to your friends and say, what's going on? Well, they say, well, they're always talking like that. And there's much more, nobody wants to go back to the way history or a lot of academic disciplines were practiced under what they remember the Soviet period. Let's remember, and for you guys, it's probably, for a lot of you guys, probably remote. We're already 23 years out. So for them, this is a memory, and it's a memory that's being drowned in 23 years of widely varying experience, but they all know that they don't want to go back to doing things that way. And so so on the one hand, you're seeing in official rhetoric this seemingly xenophobic, anti-American blah, blah, but in actual institutional life, when I go over there, I'm offered repeated opportunities for collaboration. As a matter of fact, I'm pursuing two projects with the Higher School of Economics campus in St. Petersburg, and we've got longstanding, most of us at the table here have longstanding contacts with the HSE in Moscow, as well as other state universities. So what's changed most for my field is two things. We're doing normal history now. When I came up in the 80s, we were looking at the evil other. And we were looking at the big enemy. It was very Cold War inflected. And what it did was it also made our history look exceptionalized compared to what our colleagues were writing about in French history or North American history or history of the global south. Now we're much more in conversation with colleagues in other areas, and our methodologies reflect a lot more what's going on in the field at large. The other thing is we can reconceive what the late empire was like. It used to be just sort of a narrowing road to revolution and the erection of the Bolshevik tyranny, and that was the only ending. Well, that punchline ended in 91, and it created a sense of all these other, maybe not viable possibilities, but we started looking at how people themselves were experiencing things rather than focusing on how Lenin won. It's become a lot more fun to do it. At the same time, and Kathy's already hinted at it, all the great funding we used to get has fled. That now you can go whenever you want, but you got to find a way to pay for it, and that didn't used to be a problem. So there are prices for being normal, too.
Yeah, that's the only upside of this horrible business with Putin is that maybe it will get our funding back.
Yeah. The grim fact of our field is you're always praying for an enemy. Yeah.
Ted, what do you have to say about this?
Well, a couple of things. So first of all, sociology didn't really exist in the Soviet Union. It was considered a bourgeois discipline, and so with the in the post Soviet era, I'd say it's been very slow to develop. The Russian sociology has not really taken off as one might have hoped it would. It tends to be very sort of narrowly focused on what I would characterize as a very superficial reading of survey results and the conducting of surveys. And it's failed to really try to integrate or to dialogue with international sociology as a discipline. Now, I think there are signs that that's been changing, so in particular at the Higher School of Economics, again, and also at the EUSP, those are the two institutions. I mean, Lyryshka or Ness, I think, has had some signs and a lot of potential, but I think it's really embattled these days. They have a lot of personnel changes, and it's not clear what its future is.
I think they had the best publication record before the Gurdjieff business.
Yeah, they did. Yeah, they did. Yeah, So they were the most successful.
Total Western model.
Right. That really integrated with the West. But they're mainly economists, of course, not really any sociologists. So I would say, among the disciplines, economics actually is a discipline where Russia is strongest. Of all the social science disciplines, there are some strong political scientists there, too. There's really not very many sociologists to speak of who I would consider to be sort of working at an international level, so to speak. Although, there's some young people, there's some potential. And my concern is that the people whom I like and respect, whose work I know and who I think have the right vision for social science in Russia, that the ones I've spoken to recently are all extremely depressed. So Dave and the guys are just talking, but the people I've talked to are saying, no, the country is really a different country than it was a year ago. We are very frightened. We don't see any scenario by which we're going to recover from the onslaught on academic freedom, the onslaught, the insistence that all scholarship has to toe the line and support the regime's policies, otherwise you're accused of being a traitor or part of a fifth column or being a lackey of the West. So who knows? I mean, these things have ebbed and flowed over the last several decades. We've seen periods before where it looked like the sky was falling and there was going to be a complete crackdown and return, and it sort of has blown over. This could be the same way, and we won't really know until the situation in Ukraine plays itself out, until the sanctions play, until we see
else.
In terms of my own collaborator, I haven't really collaborated in terms of working on joint projects together with Russian scholars. I actually was planning to do so this fall. I was involved in a proposal at the Higher School of Economics to go over there and spend a few months in residence and work, set up a laboratory, as they call it, for research on social inequality and work closely with Russian scholars. But as a result of the recent contretemps between our countries, I decided to pull out of that because I thought I can't really risk, or I didn't want to risk, going over there and committing to that in the current environment. I have worked closely with the Levada Analytics Center, so that's, many of you know, is, I think, the leading data collection agency in Russia. They've been independent since their inception. I guess they weren't formally independent during their inception in 1989, but they managed to, avoid falling under the direct control of state authorities throughout their history. There was an attempt to sort of take them over and dismiss the director, but then they just went and started their own company. And there have been several attempts to shut them down. They almost fell under the purview of this foreign agent law. They were visited by the prosecutor back last fall. And they were warned that they had better declare themselves to be foreign agents. So if you don't know, the Russian government in 2013 passed a law requiring all NGOs that receive foreign funding and are involved in quote-unquote political activities to declare themselves to be foreign agents, to sign up on a registry of foreign agents, and in all interaction with the public, say, we, by the way, are foreign agents. And so for a survey research firm, this would be tantamount to shutting down, because if you send surveyors to people's houses and they knock on the door and say, can we ask you some questions, and by the way, we're foreign agents, that's not going to work. So they were visited by the prosecutor, then they changed the law so initially the law said that the organizations had to declare themselves foreign agents, but then they were finding no one was willing to do that, and they were sending in prosecutors and trying to get them, threatening to do it, but still no one would do it. So then they changed the law, say, okay, the Ministry of Justice has the authority to designate organizations as foreign agents if they meet the criteria. And the Levada Center was really concerned about this. It looked like they make it shut down. As a result, they actually delayed or suspended the project that I was mentioning, this study of housing and politics. We're supposed to go over there and do focus groups last March, and not quite the last minute, but before I was about to buy plane tickets, they said, well, look, we really can't move forward with this. We need to wait and see. The Ministry of Justice did actually decide that they're not engaged in political activities, so they're not subject to being labeled, at least so far. I mean, the law could change tomorrow, the decision could change tomorrow, but the Ministry of Justice did decide that they're not foreign agents. And so based on that decision, then they said, okay, well, let's go for it. You know, I heard that there's a lot of internal debate within the organization whether they should just stop working with Americans altogether, that it's too risky, it's too dangerous, and I guess they decided that, you know, part of their mission, as they understand it, is to continue to do scholarly research, and if they don't, you know, if they refuse to work with Americans or with people of other nationalities, and they sort of lost that core mission, so they don't really have a sense of who they are and what their identity is, and so they told me, okay, we're willing to go for it. If you really take the risk of coming to Russia and seeing what happens and investing in it, you know, because the project could be shut down any minute, that there's a, you know, I have a fiduciary duty to make sure the grant money is spent well, so that I'm taking some risk on myself. But really, they're the ones who are taking the risk in working with me, and I figure if they're willing to take that risk, then I trust their judgment. And so I think, you know, for those going to the field, it's a very fraught time. I mean, I would reiterate what the others have said, that, you know, personal connections are obviously very important in Russia for anything, and that formal procedures mean almost nothing. You know, for those of you who are going to the field, it's important to try to establish some contacts. And, you know, it's funny, we probably all could tell interesting stories on others around the table about the types of contacts that have proven useful. I mean, you know, sure, of course, if your advisor or a faculty member can point you in the right direction, great. But a lot of times, just sort of random people who you meet through circles end up being extremely useful. I mean, I ended up getting to the Levada Center people when I was just a grad student. Before I ever had the money, I mean, you know, it costs a lot of money to do a survey. You have to be sort of fairly advanced in status to get the grant money that you need to actually go and hire to do this. But, you know, long before I was at it, I happened to, you know somebody who happened to know somebody who said, oh, you know, you're social, oh, you want to meet the people I know at the, it was called Tsium at the time, you know, you want to meet Zaslavska, you want to meet these people, they're, you know, you're an American sociologist, they might be interested in meeting you. So they just came by, you know, we shook hands, we had tea, and then like 5 years later, I said, hey, remember me? I was in your office. So these kinds of, you know, chance experience can prove to be very useful. And so I would certainly, you know, what Kathy said, I'd reiterate that it is much easier to travel to Russia now, sort of. It's more expensive, but, you know, but you really, more depends on your own initiative. So you got to get out there and you got to, you know, use whatever contacts you can, talk to people, talk to taxi drivers, talk to, you know, whoever you can. Try to, you know, just walk into the university and say, hey, you know. I think it's also harder because I think, you know, back when we were starting out, there was much more interest in foreigners in Russian society, that you were an exotic, you know, you were what they would call exotica, right? You, you know, just by being a foreigner, people would automatically have an interest in you. Well, that's no longer the case. I mean, if anything, they're you know, not supposed to. I mean, they're much more cautious, and they're certainly like the allure of Americans is certainly worn off, and if anything, you might be a liability now. So you do have to probably work a lot harder. You know, back in our days, we could just sort of walk down the streets and people would start talking to us. I don't think it's going to be like that days at all.
It's not the people you want
talking to. Well, not the people you want talking to, yeah, right.
Now it's normal. Like we talked about, you know, writing the normal history. Now it's sort of conducting normal scholarship.
Normal scholarship.
Being part of
an
exotica.
And I have a head too, is like in my experience too, and this is particularly for students, to not be shy to write some people. You know, because in general, they're very good in writing back and making connections for you. So if there's a particular area of study that you're interested in and you have some names and your advisor or somebody has contacts, to just write them or, you know, go see them or take them out for coffee or beer or whatever, generally kind of like gives results. So don't shy away from that. Mm-hmm. The other thing just about for before and after, I just got an email from a friend of mine who was a colleague of mine when I was in the University of Leiden in the Netherlands in the early 1980s, and we went to Moscow together. And she is kind of, I don't know how long ago you have been in any of Russia,
But she wrote me yesterday that she was back in St. Petersburg to do research, and she has an apartment, so she has to do her own shopping. And she said it was back again to beets, potatoes, and carrots.
Oh, really?
Because of the sanctions.
Oh, that really?
Because of the sanctions. So we cannot be, we cannot spend any money, actually.
Right, well.
Unless they're expensive.
Well, I think now I'd like to open up the discussion to other members of the audience. What questions do you have for our panelists? Go ahead.
No questions.
No, there's a question.
Can I ask you to speak a little bit more on your research of the protests during the election? I was in Moscow during that year, and a lot of my friends took part in the protests. I did not, as a foreigner. I figured that wasn't what they did. But what are you learning about that time?
All right, so the research we have is mainly based on surveys. So we didn't specifically do surveys at the protests. I was actually at the one after the Putin's victory on Pushkinskaya myself. What we do have, we did ask people a lot of questions about their attitudes towards the protests. And already at that time, that gave me a lot of pause about the sort of euphoria about this protest movement, because at most, so it's sort of changed a little bit over time, but at the maximum, maybe about 30% of the population, 30 to 35% expressed positive views about the protest. That was the peak. With the other remaining population divided between those who just couldn't care less and had nothing to say and those who were against it and thought it was dangerous. So. And the other interesting thing that we found was that although this was characterized as a middle-class uprising, a middle-class protest, and although some of the research that was done on the protesters themselves did suggest that they were largely drawn from professional circles, highly educated circles, there really wasn't much sign of a class variation in support for the protest. That is, you know, if you want to characterize something as a middle-class movement, you would think that by standard indicators in middle-class status, such as higher education or, you know, relatively high income or professional occupations, you would see people with those characteristics would be more likely than, say, working-class people or others to express support for the protest movement. And you don't see that in the data. So I found myself in a strange position, actually, when I was looking at these data, because, you know, a lot of my friends were involved, of course, in the protest movement, pro-democratic, and you know, I didn't want to be the one to publish an op-ed that say, look, everybody, this is not working out the way you think it is. But now, actually, I think I should come back and work with some of these data and publish some of these results, because it's sort of, in retrospect, it actually makes more sense, perhaps even than it did at the time, for those who, you know, including myself, who were swept up in the excitement of, you know, this mass mobilization. So that's sort of the bottom line of what we have on the protest movement.
Can I just follow on? Where did you do the survey? Like, how many regions are
all in Moscow? Nationally representative. Like 45 regions are covered. So it's obviously not me doing it. So I work with Levada Center. They're a survey organization with professional interviewers whom they hire to go out and implement this. And yeah, so it covered pretty much the whole territory. Geographically, we've even gone into Dagestan in the North Caucasus. We did, in several of the ways, we did have a Moscow oversample, because one of the things I realized, I probably should have realized it before, but the initial results of the survey really brought it home, is the extent to which Moscow really is a different political environment from the rest of the country. Yeah. So we have a bunch of respondents. We have a huge, you know, I think we have a total of 800, 900 respondents overall from Moscow. Because in my dreams, then I thought, well, gee, it'd be fun to do some separate analysis just of Moscow, and I haven't gotten around to that yet. Who knows if I will? Maybe somebody else will with these data. So anybody interested in politics in Moscow, talk to me. But yeah, so it's a nationally representative study.
Any questions, Andy?
Dave, Manon was saying that it pays to be Dutch. Have you ever found that it pays to be Canadian?
Always.
I mean, what are the Canadian? What is
more
the,
ways
the
than
Russians,
one?
No.
The Russians' attitudes towards Canada versus America.
You know what's interesting is they don't really have a concrete picture of us. They But they know we're not Americans.
Right.
So it makes them like many Canadians. But you got an automatic conversation. Depending on the age of the person, it's always going to be hockey. And if you're my age, there was a series, I gave a seminar on this a couple of years ago, series in 1972, which was just the Soviets, as were then, almost pulled off a huge upset over the NHL All-Stars, the first team Canada. And it was epic, and people in both countries were absolutely riveted by it. And it was punctuated by the fact that there were about 5,000 Canadian fans came to Moscow in the fall, and they were one of the first sets of guests in what was then the gleaming new Gostinice Intuitius, the bottom of Tverskaya, which is now gone.
Right.
And that left a really vivid impression. People love talking about that. And now it's with Russians in the NHL, and with the recent Olympics, and that's an automatic conversation piece. And it also, in spite of, you know, it's ironic, and it's totally unnoticed here, and it's unnoticed in Russia, but the current Canadian government has been far more assertive about sanctions and about public statements against the sitting Russian government than the American government has. And it's pushing on a rope in terms of it doesn't seem to affect anything. Right now, in a lot of parts of the world, it is better not to be American in terms of popular reception. But on the other hand, for years in the 80s, I couldn't go to the Soviet Union because the Canadian government had suspended academic ties with the Soviet state after the Afghanistan invasion. It's sort of ironic in the current context that Ukrainian Canadians are a very critical voting bloc, and they've skewed both Tory and liberal over the years, but a lot of them are farmers. And when the U.S. and the EU, as was then, were suspending wheat shipments, the Ukrainian farmers said, no, we're not doing that, but you don't send any scholars over there to study. So no, it plays out. And on the Ukrainian issue, they've never recovered. And that explains the state of their hockey, too. But no, on the Ukrainian situation, it's very interesting because the pressure in this country is all about doing something, and it's about defending America's great power thing. It's all part of a larger complex with ISIS and Israel, Gaza, and the rest of it. Whereas in Canada, it is a very distinctly focused question, and it's about solidarity with the Ukrainians, and there's not a Canadian politician who would say otherwise. And so they've been far more obdurate about these issues than the Americans or the Europeans.
I had a question about collaboration with Russian academic institutions. It sounds like most of your collaborations have been centered around Moscow and Petersburg, and specifically the Harvard School of Economics and the European University. Are there academic institutions elsewhere in Russia or other centers of university towns and stuff that you do collaborations with? Like when I was in Voronezh, it was very famous within Russia for having a bunch of universities there, and I met a couple professors who were like, oh yes, get back to me when you're a graduate student and maybe we can do something. No. But I've never heard of any other center really for Russian academic institutions besides Moscow and Petersburg.
I've done a lot of stuff in Saratov, I've done a lot of stuff in Yekaterinburg, I've been to Voronezh, done stuff with people there. So, but these are more short-term kinds of things. But yeah, the main law academies in the Soviet period were in Yekaterinburg and Saratov, and they continue to be the high profile ones. So yeah,
it's too bad Mark Johnson isn't here. He's currently in Bascom, but he's a specialist on post-Soviet higher education, and he'd tell you that about 3 years ago they did a regrouping of the universities and Ministry of the Ministry of Education and Scholarship. And now they've designated federal research universities and then sort of local centers of excellence, I guess we'd call them, and then just sort of run-of-the-mill places. And so
they...
the Glush. And it's a question of resources. Certainly, say, on the project that I'm overseeing, we've got scholars from, not from Voronezh, but from Kremenchug, from several universities in the Urals, from Siberia, from Vladimir, but they've all been they're all plugged into networks that tend to run through Moscow mm-hmm. and Peter, because that's where the resources are, that's where the contacts are. And Provincia was closed to us until 20 years ago, and so a lot of us, like Saratov, people like Kathy, and there's a guy in North Carolina, Chapel Hill, called Don Raleigh, that were pioneers in opening up that type of research. But again, given how important personal connections are, it's between the resources, the lack of personal connections, it's not occurred as immediately a likelihood as it might have.
Manon, do you have reactions to research or field research outside of?
No, I think I agree. I mean, you kind of like even if you are getting connections to the provinces and have been to Rostov and other places, it leads via Moscow.
So yeah.
It leads via connections via Moscow, and then you can sort of like get there, or you meet them in Moscow or something like that. So more than St. Petersburg. I'd say.
Yeah, it's funny. Yeah, the St. Petersburg and Moscow are sort of a duumvirate, but the Moscow is really the big hub.
Yeah. So, but it's been interesting because also kind of like it. I mean, Russia obviously, just as the United States, it's a gigantic country. So even getting to the provinces is already a hassle. You know, it's either flying, and even if you fly to. You know, relatively large places like Rostov or Vladikavkaz or something like that, you know, you kind of like you risk your life just by landing because you just get up the run.
Yeah,
anything like that.
I take the train in Russia.
Yes. And then you can take the train, but the train lasts for like a week.
Yep.
And so, it's not the easiest country to kind of like really go outside of the conveniences of the capitals.
Mm-hmm. But what about your work in the North Caucasus, in Beslan? Was mm-hmm. that through Moscow, or was that directly with
No, that was a whole different thing. I could not arrange it through Moscow. It was that was actually an illegal trip, so to speak, because I couldn't arrange it through Moscow. I couldn't arrange it through the Russian Theater Federation. And so I had a trusted companion who said, like, you know what, let's just buy Russian. Let's just buy a ticket and just go from Moscow to Vladikavkaz, and that's what we did. We just bought a ticket online from here.
Security zoned.
I could just go online on kind of like whatever kind of airline it was. I forgot that it was, and so we got two tickets. I came to Moscow, and the next day we just kind of like went to Vladikavkaz, and there what we could do was to ask an the Vladikavkaz theater person was there, director was waiting for us there in Vladikavkaz, and I was there. Vladikavkaz is the capital that is about 10 miles from Beslan, and really what I wanted to do is I want to go to Beslan because I did a workshop with the teachers of Beslan after the 2004 hostage crisis, and I felt it for myself unethical to write about Beslan and the crisis, etc., without actually going to Beslan, because it felt I was just commodifying the people there. And so I went to Vladikavkaz, and then we went to the cemetery, and we went to the school that was still standing, and then we went to Vladikavkaz. And this was all without permission. I also booked a hotel just online from the United States.
TripAdvisor recommended it.
And so then we came to the theater there, and had some sort of like a talk with the director of the theater, the artistic director of the theater, and he said, well, what do you want to do? He said, well, we want to go to visit the teachers of Beslan. And he said, like, well, you cannot do that. There's no way you can go to visit the teachers of Beslan without permission. And we had been in contact with them, but it was indeed true that after we said we were coming, they were eerily silent. And so so he said, well, wait a second. And he went on the phone, and he called the Minister of Education. And the Minister of Education said we had to be there at the Ministry of Education in exactly 15 minutes. Yeah. And so we came there, and he was kind of like, what do you want to do? So we said, we want to see the teachers of Beslan. And he went in length to say that we could see the teachers, but we could certainly not talk to children.
Well, fair
and
enough.
Said, okay, that's fine. And then he gave his deputy under minister something, the task to arrange that. And so the next day we went to visit them, which was in the new school. And it was very close because we had to go through the new director of the school. That was kind of like a little bit dicey, but then it was just fine. And then the stranger thing was that the next day they said, we are going to take you into the mountains. And so be here again. And they had hired some kind of a bus. they had the gymnastics teacher guy was there, and there were some other guys that were not part of the teaching, but they were sort of like our bodyguard. And we just drove into the mountains without kind of like probably just right outside the border. Anyway, we were there for 5 or 6 days, and then we went back, and really nothing happened. But, yeah.
Okay.
So it is possible, but it's not the easiest thing to do, let me say it that way.
But what I'm hearing from your story and from these other accounts is this combination of this melding of formal networks and informal networks,
yeah.
Because
absolutely.
You have a friend taking you down there, and then you have the meeting with the Minister of Education.
Yeah.
Other
absolutely, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm interested in the Higher School of Economics, which I don't know anything about. But what kind of institution is it? What's its relationship to the elite? What's its background in the Soviet period? And I asked that because I did a little work on Eastern Germany and Central Europe. Mm-hmm. And there are comparable institutions there, which turned out to be very important, especially in the transition period, post-Common, I think, particularly the one in Prague, which produced a number of leading Czech politicians, including Václav Klaus, after 89.
Anyone care to talk
well,
about
HSE? Well, all right. HSE? I mean, so HSE is a government university. It is located in Moscow, and the government has so they've had two rounds now where they've sort of stratified. In a nutshell, Russian higher education has too much capacity. There's too many universities. They should shut down about a third of them, but they won't, because doing so would be politically impossible. And so what they decided to do, they wanted to modernize, or they did want to modernize the system. That was the catchword of the Medvedev regime. So what they decided to do is make distinctions between these three classes of universities and give all the money and all the resources to the top, and then basically starve to death the rest of the universities. Now then, within those top designated national research universities, they had another round, another competition, where they chose five or six, who they gave even more money to, but with a very specific task. So the Russian Ministry of Education is very concerned that there are no Russian universities on the list of the top 200 universities. Is it 100 or 200?
200.
And so they had another competition where the universities had to make the case of why they have a chance of getting on the list of top 200 universities by, 2020, so they have I don't know any of the people who are going to be accountable for this. So HSE was one of this very small group of five or six universities that was designated, okay, you're really the top cream of the crop. So they have tons of money, and they are really trying to recruit international scholars. They're paying very high salaries. They certainly are getting the cream of the crop within Russia, and they have some really kooky things. Like, they'll actually pay, for American faculty, this sounds kind of enticing, actually, but they'll actually give a huge monetary bonus for publishing articles in Western journals. So if you publish an article, you can collaborate with, that's why they want people like with me to come over and collaborate.
Yeah, exactly.
But they pay me money. Well, anyway,
they also had this project a few years ago where they asked Westerners to come in and evaluate the scholarship that was being done there.
Yep.
And it was just horrific.
Right.
And
paid
us huge amounts of money.
Right.
Right.
Yeah,
and
they paid, right. Yoy was really valuable. Yoy, unfortunately,
I
had to leave, I guess. But she
was involved.
You were also doing that.
I was the pimp for the legal stuff. I had to find everybody to do it. And it was just... You know, how many times can you say that no one in the West would ever publish this stuff?
That's
but
right. It's not even close. Yeah,
and they also didn't seem to understand about blind review, because then people would find out. The idea of it was that we want to be world class, right?
Right.
And we want to have our scholarship in these journals, but yet they don't really understand
how to go
what
about
needs
it.
To be done.
So
I mean,
they're
I know
throwing
that
money
to,
at it. Is
yeah.
that what I said? They're just trying to throw money at this and seeing, let's see if we throw enough money that maybe. But what they need is fundamental reform of academic institutions, and they need
among them all, when you look at what's going on with Moscow State and Petersburg State, which are just falling apart at the seams, and scholars are fleeing them because there are places like Lavushka now that will pay really good money. Half their history department is filched from Moscow State or or Moscow State Pedagogical, which was another good institute.
Did it have a history, though?
No, it's not. It's a post-Soviet. It's post-Soviet.
Yeah,
post-Soviet.
Yeah. So it is,
and with the law, with
yeah.
the law people, it has a very interesting yeah. profile. I mean, I always think of it as the box of broken toys, because every judge that gets kicked off for some political reason ends up there, right? Morshakova is there, you know, Pashin is, all these people that have high profiles in terms of having been kicked off the bench are there and stay there, right? So they don't, there seems to be some tolerance of high profile people that...
Yeah, yeah, and it's interesting they've got a Krisha, a protector, actually the same one as the European University, former finance minister named Kudrin, who, and if you're looking at it analytically, and I defer to the political scientists, but the one thing that's impressed me in the last 10 months is, for all that you're seeing this tightening of the screws, they're keeping their options open. And they're not totally foreclosing, like Kudrin, or I saw today in Kommersant, who was at the guy that owns all the nickel stuff and that, Patanin. I can't remember if it was Patanin or another oligarch. But he just saying, look, if we don't get this taken care of, it's going to be 40% inflation by the end of next year. And I mean, you're hearing voices there that you wouldn't have heard under the Soviet period, and at the same time as you're hearing just major loons on the other side saying their stuff. But and the enforcement of laws, a lot of the laws they're talking about as well, doesn't seem to occur with the same rigor as one might expect in Georgia or Louisiana. So.
Other questions? Well, if there are no other questions, I'd like to take the opportunity to thank our panelists. And I'll ask you to hang out here for a few minutes if you. As,